I'd like to continue on my discussion of economic myths. I guess I could call these interventionist myths. And so I took on the big topic of the Great Depression for this topic. And I think what I'd like to start with is a discussion of what I call, in my book on capitalism, called the American way of dealing with recessions. Because it was the way in which Americans dealt in terms of economic policy with recessions or depressions really until the Great Depression of the 1930s. And that was basically to either do nothing or to deregulate. That was basically what was done by most government administrations to deal with recessions. And a good example of that is President Martin Van Buren, who was president of the United States, is elected in 1836. And I'm going to read you just a couple of statements by Van Buren on his philosophy of what to do, because 1837, there was a deep recession, if not a depression, in the economy. So bad luck on his part. He gets elected, and this recession was just about to begin. And he said things like, "All communities are apt to look to government for too much, especially at periods of sudden embarrassment and distress." And he was referring to this depression. And he said, "Moreover, all former attempts on the part of government to assume the management of domestic or foreign exchange had proved injurious," end quote. And so all former meddling interventionism as a response to recession made things worse. And he said, "What was needed was," quote, "a system founded on private interest, enterprise, and competition, without the aid of legislative grants or regulations by law," end quote. And that was a president of the United States saying that. His actions were consistent with his words, as is not always the case. Ronald Reagan was a great speech maker, especially before he became president, but his actions were often different than his speeches. And it's the same is true of just about every president. But in Van Buren's case, he stuck to his rhetoric. And there was financial market deregulation that he supported and helped get passed. For example, there was a law, and Jeffrey Hummel, I read about this. I didn't know about this. I read about this in Jeffrey Hummel's book that I've mentioned several times. There was a law actually that forced commercial banks to buy some of these worthless bonds that state governments issued to finance so-called internal improvement projects, the ones that were championed by Abraham Lincoln in Illinois, for example. They actually got a federal law forcing these banks to buy these bonds, which turned out to be useless. And so Van Buren was instrumental in getting rid of that. There were banking regulations that prohibited branch banking, as there were in the modern era. And he understood that that was a bad idea, too. So there actually was financial market deregulation. Van Buren was an advocate of hard money, and he helped the eventual creation in the early 1840s of what was called the independent treasury system, which made currency redeemable in gold and silver. There were no pork barrel spending. He didn't do what modern presidents always have done, especially beginning with Roosevelt and Hoover, his predecessor, is spend money like crazy on road building or canal building. He was opposed to the so-called internal improvements projects financed by taxes, and he vetoed any bills that came across his desk to spend tax money on this sort of thing. There was no federal bailout of state governments, even though the state governments were in pretty bad shape financially. The Van Buren administration cut federal spending in absolute dollars by 21%. From 1836 to 1840, the federal spending actually declined by 21%. There were no price controls, and he did what he could to move closer to free trade. He was a free trader and did what he could to open up trade. And so as a result, it was a deep recession, but very short. It didn't last that long. And that was what I think of as the American way of dealing with recessions. They didn't do much, probably because macroeconomics hadn't been invented yet. That's probably the main reason that they had no philosophical rationale for doing otherwise. And plus, they had a lot of bad experience to point to, as Van Buren did. they might not have had a theoretical framework, but they had a lot of bad experience with interventionism. And so, well, anyway, Herbert Hoover, I'm supposed to be talking about the Great Depression. Probably the biggest economic myth there is that laissez-faire capitalism caused the Great Depression, and interventionism and the New Deal cured the Great Depression. False. Not true. The Hoover administration was anything but interventionist. There was a lot of monetary expansion in the 1920s. The money supply increased by almost 70% during that decade, and I'll talk about the ramifications of that in a minute. But you know, Herbert Hoover is credited with being a laissez-faire advocate of laissez-faire capitalism, and if you read some of the things he wrote after he got out of office, they were pretty good. They could be published by the Mises Institute even. And of course, he used some of his wealth to found the Hoover Institution in California. But like a lot of other politicians, I think we were talking last night, even Thomas Jefferson, who was, philosophically was great before he was president, but once he got in office, the pressures of politics changed him. You know, he had to, if he wanted to succeed as a politician, he had to compromise. And that's what politicians do. So he wasn't that good of a president in my eyes. But his political philosophy was tremendous. And the same is true with Hoover. But if you look at what he actually did and what he stood for policy-wise, it was interventionism. He was a progressive. He was not a capitalist, an advocate of laissez-faire. What did he do? Well, he pressured businesses to raise wages when the economy was slowing down near the end of his term. Pressured. Now, when you say government pressures somebody, I think of it as or negotiates with somebody. I always think of it as gun under the table negotiation. There's always some sort of hidden threat there. Either you do what I'm suggesting, or something bad's going to happen to you. You'll be audited, I'll sign this law that will put a special excise tax on your industry, something like that. So when you negotiate with government, it's never an even negotiation. And he held hundreds of conferences, literally hundreds, with different trade groups, industry groups, to try to get them to raise wages. And this was essentially the agenda of labor unions that Hoover was promoting. And all of this was codified during the Roosevelt administration by labor laws that changed. In fact, in my book, I quote Rexford Tugwell, who was FDR's chief economic advisor from 1932 to 1935, as saying that most of the ideas for the New Deal came from Herbert Hoover. They just went further and codified in law a lot of the things that he was trying to get done somehow through pressure or persuasion, bribery, threats. That's what politicians do. He also pleaded with business people to engage in work sharing, which is sort of a socialist idea of instead of having 10 people working 40 hours a week, why don't you hire 20 people and have them work 20 hours a week? He thought that would reduce unemployment. But of course, the only way to reduce unemployment is through more production. That's the only way to do it. This is just rearranging the chairs in the Titanic, work sharing, sort of a socialistic idea. Unlike Van Buren and other predecessors, Herbert Hoover started the binging on pork barrel public works spending. It wasn't Roosevelt that initiated this. It was Herbert Hoover. He spent 13% of the federal budget on public works alone in the first couple of years of his administration. And, of course, to do that, he had to raise taxes enormously. So we had some of the biggest tax increases in American history up to that point under Herbert Hoover. And Murray Rothbard's book, America's Great Depression, is a great resource on Herbert Hoover. It's basically about the Hoover administration for the most part. And if you want to read up about all the tax increases and so forth, that's where to find it. It was Hoover who started the business of government-supervised farm cartels, the business of paying farmers to not grow food, to not raise livestock, and so forth. That started with Herbert Hoover. Now, you don't have to be a PhD student in economics to understand that if the problem is unemployment and the government is taking one big sector of the economy, farming, and is paying people not to hire farm workers and to not provide grow food, that's not going to be good for reducing unemployment. He's paying people to not hire farm workers. That's essentially what they were doing. That's why these programs that continued in a much larger degree during the FDR's administration were a disaster for southern sharecroppers, especially low-income southern sharecroppers. When they cut back on agricultural production, they were hurt as hard as anyone during the Great Depression. There was massive unemployment among the southern sharecroppers because fewer crops were being grown, and that was government policy for fewer crops to be grown because they wanted to raise the price of food. That was FDR's intention. That was Hoover's intention. They had the cockamamie idea that the Great Depression was caused by low prices. Therefore, if we could just have high prices, the depression will end. Just like that. That was basically the theory. Hoover signed the Smoot-Hawley Tariff, which should be called the Smoot-Hawley-Hoover Tariff because he initiated the whole thing. He went to Congress and said, we need to raise the tariff. Okay, we're in a recession. A recession is approaching. Therefore, what do we need to do? Cut off trade. Restrict economic activity even more. And so he went to Congress, and then Smoot and Hawley, two members of Congress, sponsored the bill. And this raised the average tariff rate to just under 60%, 60%. And as a result, there was an international trade war. The volume of international trade by the 75 top trading countries who engage in most of the world trade fell by about 80% in 3 years. American exports fell by 53% from 1929 to 1932 in just really 2 years, because this was the end, 1930 really, when this kicked in. And so that was quite the disaster that Hoover was responsible for. It really should be called the Smoot-Hawley-Hoover Tariff. He also socialized investment by allocating billions of dollars to something called the Reconstruction Finance Corporation that would gave the government billions of dollars in investment through loan guarantees primarily. So the government got in the business of directing the allocation of capital. And, of course, whenever the government directs the allocation of capital, it won't be economic criteria that are used. It'll be political criteria for the most part. How can we buy votes by making low-interest loans to this or that industry or this or that region of the country? That's what will happen. When I talk about this to my students, even my example is getting dated now. I should come up with a new example. I ask them, just think about it. If in the late 70s, when Microsoft was just being invented, like Bill Gates dropping out of Harvard and he and his colleagues creating Microsoft, what if it depended on government credit allocation, government capital allocation, not private capital? And we did have a government agency like the RFC, which was eventually ended in the 1950s. And they were dependent on government capital, government loans or preferred loans. And here are your choices. You're a politician. Here are your choices of who to give the capital to. A Harvard dropout who looks like the geek of the year with the big glasses and the long hair and skinny and Bill Gates. And his buddies who look just like him. And what are they doing? They're messing around in his dad's garage in Palo Alto. Or IBM, give the money to IBM. Or give the money to the company that's located in the district of the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee. Who is likely to get that low-interest loan? It's not likely to be the entrepreneurs in Bill Gates' dad's garage. I guarantee you that. And so that's how political capital allocation takes place. And this was started by Hoover, and so he put a big distortion into the capital markets by this. And it lasted until the 1950s, when it became so corrupt that it became such a big embarrassment that they ended it around 1955. They were making loans to, I think the last straw was they were making millions of dollars of loans to strip clubs. And that was in the 50s. I guess that was too much even for Eisenhower. And so And so that ended it. But the guy who was the head of it, was a man named Jesse Jones, wrote his autobiography called $50 Billion. And the book is how he spent $50 Billion. And it was all, and I read that once, and it was, he was bragging. He would say things like, "We even loaned money on a drove of reindeer in Alaska." So I guess they were trying to buy votes in Alaska during the Great Depression. That was an important thing, reindeer in Alaska. They need a capital subsidy. So that was that's what Hoover was involved in. And also there was monetary expansion, as I said, pretty severe monetary expansion from 21 to 29. That fueled the Roaring Twenties, helped the Roaring Twenties roar. But, of course, that created a misallocation, an even bigger misallocation of capital, which I think is what the main cause of the Depression was. But then FDR comes along, and of course I mentioned that this is a myth. I said that FDR cured the Great Depression is a myth. And you don't have to look very far to understand why this is a myth. By any measure of statistics regarding the economic well-being that you could dig up, you can see that the Great Depression never ended during Roosevelt's term prior to World War II. In 1929, the average unemployment rate, the normal unemployment rate, was 3.2%. That was sort of the natural rate of unemployment at that time. But, as you can see, if you can read this, by 1940, it was still 14.6%, almost five times the normal unemployment rate. It was all the way up to 19% by 1938. And also, if you look at other measures, such as per capita GNP, it was lower in 1939 than it was in 1929. And per capita personal consumption was lower in 1939 than it was in 1929. So by any measure of economic well-being, on the eve of World War II, the Great Depression was still going strong, despite all the New Deal programs that you've all heard about. And of course, World War II didn't end the Great Depression, because it really is a joke, isn't it, to think that, we're going to send 16 million men out of the country and then say, "Hey, no more unemployment. Aren't I smart? I cured the unemployment problem." That doesn't cure the unemployment problem. In fact, standards of living continue to get worse because they had rationing of meat and price controls. And that's another thing with price controls. The economic statistics for the war years are really meaningless because the prices of all the goods that are measured in the GDP statistics are all government-mandated price control prices. They're not market prices. So you're comparing apples and oranges. You're comparing GDP measured at market prices with GDP in this sort of centrally planned economy during the Great Depression. And so those statistics on economic activity during the war years really don't show you anything. It should largely be ignored. They're just a mess. And anyway, logically, it just doesn't make sense that, when we talk about ending unemployment or ending a depression, why do we want to do that? Well, we want people to have jobs and earn income and work and have a better standard of living, better housing, better nutrition. That didn't happen during the war. 16 million men were sent to the Pacific and into Europe to fight in the war. That was not, their lives weren't better, their lives were worse. Many of them were killed. And so the Great Depression never did really end until after World War II, when between 1945 and 1947, the federal budget, with the demobilization of the army, the federal budget in absolute dollars was reduced by two-thirds. It was from 92 billion to 30 billion in that range. So it went from the 90 billion range to the 30 billion range in absolute dollars. And that, of course, all that money put back into the pockets of investors and consumers, that's what fueled the recovery, not these programs. And so he never did end the Great Depression. Even though a lot of politicians to this day and scholars think he did, including, let's see if I can find this quote from the well-known economic scholar Newt Gingrich. I had one here somewhere. Where was that? Yeah, I should have dug it up earlier. Maybe I'll dig it up before the end. But I did have a quote here from Newt praising FDR for ending the Great Depression, and praising him to the treetops for that. Well, what did FDR do? What did FDR do? Well, briefly, the first New Deal was basically a giant price-fixing scheme. The first New Deal, the hallmarks of what is called the first New Deal, 33 to 35, was the Agricultural Adjustment Administration, which was a massive scheme by the government to pay farmers for not growing food in various ways, acreage allotments to restrict the number of acres that it can legally be planted, and all in an effort to prop up the prices that farmers got and farm incomes, supposedly. Okay, so it's a cartel, a government-enforced cartel. And then there was the National Industrial Recovery Act that tried to do the same thing for the rest of the economy, to fix prices. There were price codes for all industries, and there were swarms of bureaucrats running around trying to enforce the price codes, which was another cartel price-fixing scheme. As I said earlier, the basic theory that they had was the Depression was caused by low prices. Therefore, if we can use price controls to raise prices, we'll end the Depression. They had it backwards, of course. The Depression was not caused by low prices. The Depression caused low prices. So they had it all backwards. And so Henry Hazlitt, who we consider to be an Austrian, he certainly understood all this from the very beginning. And I have one good quote from Hazlitt of how this worked out. This was from the December 1933 issue of the American Mercury, edited by H.L. Mencken. Hazlitt wrote that the American consumer is to become the victim of a series of trades and industries which, in the name of, quote, fair competition, will be in effect monopolies, consisting of units that agree not to make too serious an effort to undersell each other, restricting production, fixing prices, doing everything, in fact, that monopolies are formed to do. Instead of a relatively flexible system with some power of adjustment to fluid world economic conditions, we shall have an inadjustable structure constantly attempting, at the cost of stagnant business and employment, to resist these conditions. So Hazlitt, this is 1933, he immediately understood what this was going to be. What this is going to be is a classic cartel scheme enforced by the government. Even though we had antitrust laws at this time supposedly designed to prohibit this, when the government does it, it's fine. It's okay. And that's exactly what happened. So that was 1933. It took the main, and Hazlitt is a well-known Austrian school economist, took the mainstream of the economics profession until 2004 to understand this. So the Austrians were about 75 years ahead of the mainstream. And I say this because there was an article in the August 2004 Journal of Political Economy, which is one of the top, if not the very top, peer-reviewed academic journal in the field of economics, either the American Economic Review or the JPE or all one and two in the eyes of most economists. And there was an article by one of the editors of the AEA. Co-authors are UCLA economists Harold Cole and Lee Ohanian. And the article is called New Deal Policies and the Persistence of the Great Depression, a General Equilibrium Analysis. And you read this article, and there's a lot of math and economic models in it, but the authors they sort of express surprise at what they discovered by studying this period of the New Deal. And I'll read you what they conclude. New Deal labor and industrial policies did not lift the economy out of the Depression. Instead, the joint policies of increasing labor's bargaining power, which I'm going to talk about in a minute, and linking collusion with paying high wages prevented a normal recovery by creating rents and an inefficient insider-outsider friction that raised wages significantly and restricted employment. The abandonment of these policies coincided with the strong economic recovery of the 1940s. So it took until 2004 for the mainstream of the economics profession to sift through the cloud created by all the mathematical models and the mumbo jumbo and the lingo of economics to take a look at what actually happened. And even then, they can't just take a look at what happened. They have to create a general equilibrium model to explain what happened. And it's just these models, in my opinion, is why they never understood what the heck did happen. And some of the language that they use in economics is a good example of why it's almost impossible to understand things like the Great Depression if you become a general equilibrium modeler. Let's see if I can find a good one here. Oh yeah, I wrote in one of my publications that the theory, some of the theories written up by people like these guys in the JPE, they sort of look at the economy as kind of like a Frankenstein monster. And here's what they say. The weak recovery during the Great Depression, the weak recovery is puzzling because the large negative shocks that some economists believe caused the downturn, including monetary shocks, productivity shocks, and banking shocks, became positive after 1933. And so now I read this, I hear shocks, and I just, in my warped mind, I think of the movie Young Frankenstein, with Frankenstein sitting there being shocked into life, you know, and that's how economists talk. They try to shock the economy into life. And he talked about negative shocks caused the depression, and so they were sapping the energy from Frankenstein laying there on the table with Gene Wilder hovering over him. But he says, you know, after 1933, these shocks became positive. What were these shocks? Government spending, monetary inflation. So they tried to shock the monster into life. And guess what? It didn't work. You know, unlike the Frankenstein monster story where it did work, it did work. And so they failed to shock the beast into becoming a living being once again. And how are they supposed to do this? With various injections of government spending or easy credit. So they tried shocking him, and that didn't work, so they brought out the big needles and inject him, and it still didn't work. And I'm not making this up. They're using these words, injection, shock, they say that they would have expected a roaring recovery. Maybe you haven't all seen the movie, but you know when Frankenstein does come to life, he roars, doesn't he? Makes a big loud noise. But it's just ridiculous. And so you guys are PhD students in economics. You're just the beginning of having to learn all this stuff. Good luck. Good luck to you. But I think it's because of that kind of nonsense that, you know, how many years ago? Here's a calculator from 1933. Here's old Hazlitt. Immediately recognize that this is a government cartel scheme. What do cartels do? They restrict output. What happens when you restrict output? You restrict employment too, don't you? That's exactly what you do. And so you create more unemployment, not less. And these guys just discovered that because for a brief moment they got away from their macroeconomic models and looked at a microeconomics book, apparently, and said, hey, look at this. There's a section on cartels here. What does it say there? And they got it. They got what happened. And so the first New Deal was all declared unconstitutional by the U.S. Supreme Court in 1935. But Roosevelt did get around a lot of it. A lot of his agricultural programs that were restricting production, he just started calling them soil conservation programs. We're conserving soil. We're not restricting output and raising prices for farmers. We're conserving soil. So they did that. Then the second New Deal, what's considered to be the second New Deal, is mostly a lot of labor legislation that affected labor markets. It's primarily labor market legislation and a continuation of all the spending and the taxing with all the public works. I think there were between 10 and 11 million people who were given public works jobs. But, of course, all that money to pay for those jobs had to be taken out of the taxpayers' hides. And so there was a big diversion of employment that caused less private sector employment because of all that money taken out of the private sector, and it pumped up government employment. and to do all sorts of things. And so, but on net, it didn't increase employment. In fact, it always reduces overall employment because the private sector always spends the money better, more efficiently than government does. And so on net, it would increase unemployment. So we had the Social Security Act, which imposed a Social Security payroll tax. That makes it more expensive to hire people. We had a minimum wage law, federal minimum wage law, unemployment insurance taxes. That makes it more expensive to hire people. We had the National Labor Relations Act, which greatly empowered labor unions in many ways. And I don't want to go over the big long list of the ways it did so. But we also had the Norris LaGuardia Act that was signed by Herbert Hoover, but it was enforced vigorously by the Roosevelt administration. And one of the things that did, the Norris LaGuardia Act, was made it very difficult, almost impossible, to do anything about union violence. It exempted unions from the normal prosecution for various types of violent behavior. They couldn't get away with murder necessarily, but a lot of other stuff, as long as they were engaged in trying to get better wages and working conditions, the courts would often look the other way at what the things they were doing. So as a result, strikes were much more prevalent, and because of the boost in union power created by all this legislation, in 1937 alone, and what's the unemployment rate is still almost 17% in 1936, wages went up by about 14% in 1937 alone, during the heart of the Great Depression. And so and what that means is that when you're in a depression and consumer demand is falling, what is also falling is what we call the derived demand for labor. When there are fewer customers, businesses have a lower demand for labor to produce goods and services to cater to the customers. And so the only way to minimize the disemployment effect of a recession is to allow wages to be flexible. If wages can go down, at least you'll keep your job, is one way of looking at it. If you can take a pay cut, at least you'll keep a job at a lower pay. Hopefully it's temporary. But what was happening was the pay was being forced up, not only by the federal minimum wage law, but by the union power, at least in those segments of the economy, not necessarily universally. But the union part of the economy was a big part of the economy in those days, in the 1930s. And so rather than allowing wages to be flexible downwards, all the government policy was aimed at pushing them up. And that, of course, would cause even more unemployment than would otherwise have occurred. And Richard Vedder and Lowell Galloway, in their book Out of Work, do this statistical analysis that they estimate that the unemployment rate in the U.S. as a result of this legislation was about 8 points higher than it would have been otherwise. So they're saying instead of 19% unemployment in 1938, it would have been 11% in 1938. Or by 1940, instead of almost 15%, it would have been about 7%. And that's getting closer to normal. You know, normal was 3.5%. And so even if their estimate is off, which they always are, it's still they still show that there was a pretty big negative effect there as a result of this. And so nothing that Roosevelt did was good for the economy. The first New Deal was a giant cartel scheme that was harmful to the economy. He raised taxes tremendously. Public works spending, that was bad too. It took more money out of the economy. The second New Deal empowered labor unions for the most part, made it more costly to hire people. That created more unemployment. And so the cynics out there, including me, would argue that maybe that's why he was so eager to get into World War II. All this, 7 years of the New Deal was a total flop. Didn't work. It didn't work. There was also quite the pork barrel aspect of the New Deal. So all this spending, you know, those of you who have ever talked to your grandparents and their parents, some of you, about the New Deal, they'll tell you how grateful they were for these jobs they got, and how if it wasn't for Roosevelt, the family would have starved and that sort of thing. Well, that's why we study economics, so you can understand why your senile old grandfather is not right about this, and that you don't and that you don't go and tell your children the same story. That's why we study economics. But there's fairly recently there's been some research by public choice scholars like Bill Shugart and one of his students and a few others on sort of the political economy or the public choice aspects of how the money was spent. The typical assumption is that while they did spend a lot of this money, out of the goodness of their hearts, they spent billions in other people's money to try to alleviate poverty during the Great Depression. So, you know, you can make the case, I suppose, that well, certainly somebody benefited from all this. You can't spend all these billions and nobody benefits. Somebody benefits, and the question is, well, who exactly benefited? Was it the people who were made worse off? The South was the worst part of the economy during the Great Depression, especially places like Mississippi. The Mississippi Delta was an awful place economically to be in the 1930s. But there's a lot of evidence that the main criterion for this spending, get this, I'm not making this up, politics. You know, it wasn't the alleviation of poverty necessarily. And for years there have been a lot of anecdotes about this, but modern scholars, well, economists in particular, have begun doing more systematic research. But let me give you some of these anecdotes that illustrate how the money was spent. And this is from a United States Senate committee on campaign spending. Republicans in Kentucky were told they would have to change party affiliations if they wanted to keep their government jobs. In Pennsylvania, businessmen who leased trucks to the government were solicited for $100 campaign contributions. Pennsylvania government job workers, WPA workers, were told to change their party affiliation if they wanted to keep their jobs. Many people refused and were fired. Tennessee Works Progress Administration workers were also instructed to contribute 2% of their salaries to the Democratic Party as a condition of unemployment. In one congressional district in Cook County, Illinois, the WPA instructed 450 of its employees to canvass for Democratic votes around election time in 1938. The men were all laid off the day after the election. So even during the Roosevelt administration, there was a Senate investigation of how this money was used to buy votes, first and foremost, not so much to alleviate poverty where it was worst. And there's a book written by Bill Shugart and William Couch, who Couch's doctoral dissertation at the University of Mississippi, where Shugart teaches. And it's a statistical analysis of the spending during the New Deal, all the pork barrel spending. And I'll read you one of their conclusions. And I think it's called The Political Economy of the New Deal is the name of the book. It's an excellent book if you're interested in this topic from an economic perspective of economics. They say the distribution of the billions of dollars appropriated by Congress to prime the economic pump was guided less by considerations of economic need than by the forces of ordinary politics. Perhaps the New Deal failed as a matter of economic policy because it was so successful in building a winning political coalition. FDR was reelected overwhelmingly in 1936 and again in 1940, in part due to the support of the big city machines, organized labor, and other constituencies, which benefited disproportionately from New Deal largesse. So that's where most of the money went, they found, to the people who would support the Democratic Party. And then he says, insofar as the region was safe for Democrats, the administration's comparative neglect of the nation's number one economic problem, the South, can likewise be explained by politics. The South was solidly Democratic. The Republican Party, after all, was the party of Lincoln. Nobody was voting Republican, you know, hardly at all in the South, and so they were safe. They knew in those days that the South would vote Democrat. They're not going to vote Republican. And this was true until relatively recently, until 20 or 25 years ago, that because of Lincoln, the South was Democratic. And so they felt they didn't need to spend that much money there. They're in their pocket already politically, so why waste the money? Buy votes out in you know, California or someplace where the margins, the electoral margins are thin, and we need to bribe people to vote for us. And so that's what Shugart and Couch found was was the main determinant of all this spending during the Great Depression. And so that's pretty much my story about the Great Depression, that Herbert Hoover, if you study him, if you read almost any book about him, he was a big interventionist. There's even a book about him called, I think it's called Herbert Hoover, The Forgotten Progressive, and where they argue that he fits right into the progressives, and which were the socialistic interventionists of the early 20th century. He was just sort of the last progressive to achieve high office. When Hoover was, he was the head of the U.S. Department of Commerce in the 1920s, and when he got there, he created 30 new departments and hired 3,000 more bureaucrats. And that's not a laissez-faire kind of guy. That's somebody who thought he could centrally plan the whole economy through the Department of Commerce. And one of the books I read about him says this made him very famous, because he was sticking his nose into almost every industry in America some way or another, and it's made him famous. That's got him elected president. He was an engineer, and he apparently believed that since he was successful as a mining engineer, well, social engineering ought to be a snap. You know, if we can figure out how to get all that coal out of underneath those mountains, you know, the rest of society is nothing, because it's darn tough underneath those coal mines. And so he was a big social engineer. And I might as well dig out that exact quote from Rexford Tugwell. Rexford Tugwell, by the way, was a big admirer of Stalin. He wrote a book on America's economy. I think it was called America's Economy in 1930. Where he praised Stalin and Soviet central planning to the treetops, and urged America to become more like that. But here's what he said in 1946, after Roosevelt was dead. Tugwell, who taught at Columbia, said the ideas embodied in the New Deal legislation were a compilation of those which had come to maturity under President Herbert Hoover's aegis. We all of us owed much to Hoover. So it was pretty much a continuation of the interventionism of the Hoover years. And let me read you one of the things he says about his admiration for Stalin, since I mentioned that. Oh, yeah, he said, American Economic Life is the name of Tugwell's book, 1930. And he was Roosevelt's top economic advisor from 1932 to 1945, the whole duration. He said, the Soviet Union's worst enemies are being forced to admit that the system appears to be able to produce goods in greater quantities than the old one and to spread such prosperity as there is over wider areas of the population. That's the Soviet Union. He said, Soviet planning enabled them to, quote, carry out their industrial operations in accordance with a completely thought-out program. Now, that's something different than what we do here, he was saying. And he says, the major advantages of the Soviet program outweigh the disadvantages, even though the available evidence suggests that there are admittedly those who suffer under it. Under Soviet, this is 1930, and the Ukrainians would come to mind. So even though there are those who suffer under it, Tugwell said, the major advantages outweigh the disadvantages of the supposed loss of incentive under communism, the red tape, unimaginative centralized authority. So he put the word supposed in there. Tugwell said, well, there is a, quote, certain ruthlessness and disregard for liberties and rights in the Soviet Union, as well as repression, spying, and violence. So he does admit that. But still, the next line is, anyone interested in peace, prosperity, and progress must, in the coming years, devote much study and thought to Russia and the Russians. End quote. That was 2 years before Roosevelt picked him as his top economic advisor. So you can understand why they were clueless, I think, as to what to do about the Great Depression, and why Roosevelt himself was surrounded by people who wanted him to go much further in terms of interventionism. And he eventually did, I guess, with World War II. But that's all I'm going to say about this for now. We'll have time for questions and comments. And brilliant commentary. I forgot to leave, include that.
I have this comment. My girlfriend's old high school, her teacher, her history teacher, said that if anyone in her class put for the cause of the end of the Great Depression, Roosevelt or World War II or the New Deal, then they would receive an automatic F for the course.
No, really, if they gave Roosevelt credit for ending the New Deal? Well, that sounds like a good teacher to me.
I don't know if you know Dr. Warren Carroll at all.
I don't know.
That's
his wife. Well, good for her. That's she must have read my book. Okay. Well, that's good to hear. There's something good going on out there. Any other questions or comments?
At the end of World War II, when all Americans were celebrating the end of the war, the beginning of the peace, I'm just thinking that Keynesian economist at the time must have been having a hissy fit about the idea of demobilization and cutting back the government and going right back into the Great Depression.
Oh yeah, I have when I teach a course in American economic history, and when I usually have a couple of students who have taken or that semester will be taking intermediate macroeconomics, and when I tell them that the federal budget was cut by 2/3 in 2 years. And the economy took off. Most of them think I'm lying. I think I have to bring the statistical abstract in and show them the page where it says that, because that totally flies in the face of Keynesianism. That is, yeah, you're right. They must have been in a panic, and that's one of the reasons why the Keynesians they advocated the GI Bill, because they thought with all these soldiers coming back looking for jobs, it's going to be a disaster. Unemployment's going to be 25% again. So we need to get these people and put them in school somewhere. Use tax dollars, a trade school, college, anywhere. And so that was part of the Keynesian hysteria, I think, over the bad news of the war ending and all this money going back into private hands. And of course, even worse yet would be if those people came back and started saving some of that money, right? From a Keynesian's perspective, if they came back and got, it's bad enough that they got started looking for a job, but they started saving that money. Because the Keynesians, at least when I was in school, the textbooks always had a picture of a bathtub in the first chapter with injections and leakages. And the leakages were bad. That was savings. You save your money. It's a leak. Have you seen that in some of your books? It's a leakage, and that's not a good thing. It's like the blood is draining from your body, and somebody please plug the leak. Stop me from saving. But even that had the unintended side effect of that. I wrote an article in The Free Market years ago called The Truth About the GI Bill, and I traced a little bit about how it sort of led to the inevitably toward federal control of higher education, because the government started giving all this money to people to go to trade schools, and a lot of the trade schools were phony operations. They weren't a school after all. They were just collecting government checks and not educating everybody. And so the government said, well, then we have to monitor what goes on at these places if it's government money. And that led to the accreditation of higher education, of colleges. And so that has led to such things as, I think in this article I mentioned a then-current example of I think it was Westminster Theological Seminary, which their religion does not believe in the ordination of women as priests. And so the federal accreditation agency came by and said, your academic programs are fine, but we refuse to give you accreditation because you don't ordain women priests. And so they didn't like their religion, therefore they wouldn't give them the accreditation. And if you're not accredited, you can't get... your students can't get federal loans and that sort of thing, and that could have been ruinous. And so they had, at the time I wrote that, they were going to court to sue because this could have totally ruined the place. But that's but I see the GI Bill as the genesis of this political correctness, the whole mess. And so you can blame that on John Maynard Keynes if you follow what Mark is saying. Yes, sir.
If there have been any books written devoted to analyzing all the security legislation passed during the 30s in terms of the origins of it and the impact of the same.
Security?
Yeah, because it was also not only
Yeah.
You know, the SEC was
created. Oh, yeah, the Securities Exchange Commission. Yeah, I didn't mention everything, all that stuff. Oh, yeah, there's been a lot on that sort of thing. I can dig up some references for you and give them to you. But a good reference is right outside that door. It's a book called Crisis and Leviathan by Robert Higgs. I don't know, you may already have it, I don't know. But it's a good history of the Great Depression. You know, he has numerous chapters on that. And I think he does mention the SEC, but it's not a book on the SEC. But I know in the Journal of Law and Economics over the years, there have been quite a few articles by Chicago School scholars on the effects of the SEC.
Historians still dislike Hoover for the wrong reason. General textbooks paint him as a laissez-faire defender, the state that he sort of set back and did nothing while the Depression was raging. According to some historians who have explored this myth, it's because Hoover claimed that he was a defender of laissez-faire in his autobiography, so the historiography has suffered in the decades since due to that. Is this same myth present in the field of economics, and if so, how did it get started?
Oh, yeah, I think it is. I quoted the great economic theorist Newt Gingrich earlier, as credited him with saying that view. But that's probably how it got started. I'm not sure. I haven't studied the whole history of that myth. But like I said, this article from the Journal of Political Economy, I just shake my head at this stuff. That's why these guys, this is like two of the supposed top economists in the country from UCLA writing an article in the year 2004, discovering for the first time that the Great Depression or the New Deal didn't work. I mean, that's the tone of the article anyway, and that's why it's published in this prestigious journal. It's supposed to be new research, you know, path-breaking research that didn't work. And so, you know, they didn't seem to understand that, because they have this Keynesian mindset that all these shocks and injections is what eventually did end the Depression, and that Hoover's problem is he wasn't shocking and injecting enough, apparently. So if you have that sort of Keynesian mindset, that's the way you'll think. But if you understand Austrian economics or common sense, you're not likely to think that way. And so, I think it still is. But economists don't write much about Hoover and the Great Depression. There's this belief among modern economists that anything older than maybe the last two or three issues of the top journals is really not worth looking at. And so, apart from people like Bob Higgs and myself and sort of a small band of people who are interested in economic history, all the top journals, the prestigious journals, they have no concern whatsoever for these topics. It's too old. It's not sexy enough. Even though it's, I think it's pretty important. Pretty important issues. Hello, you had your hand up. Did you have a question?
I was just going to comment that Jim Powell's book, Fierce Policy, mentions Stigler's article, Expectancy
Committee,
of the SEC.
Oh, yeah.
And how little they've helped.
Yeah. Oh, that's right. Yeah, Steve, FDR's Folly, which I don't know if it's for sale out here or not, but by Jim Powell. He does a pretty good chronology of all the alphabet agencies of the New Deal with references in the back. So that would be a good one.
One of the big myths of the Great Depression is that the Fed was doing everything absolutely correctly through the 1920s, and then Benjamin Strong died, and they made mistakes after the Great Depression started. That actually could have prevented the whole thing from happening in the first place.
Yeah. Well, I think, in my book, I think Rothbard had it right more, and Friedman has it wrong, that the monetary expansion. I think it's a good case of the Austrian business cycle theory, the Great Depression, explaining it. And, of course, Friedman's take is the opposite, that the Fed was too restrictive, and that's what caused the big crash. But I don't buy his interpretation myself. But yeah, that's another big myth, I suppose, about the Fed. But it's one of those things you're never going to convince the Chicago scholars, because they fundamentally don't believe the Austrian analysis of the boom and bust cycle. So
one of the reasons that the mainstream seems to understand the Great Depression, but they think of inflation there in terms of rising prices. And prices were fairly stable during the period that we say is inflationary. But that's because we see it in kind of factual terms.
Right.
In terms of where are prices higher than they would have been if there was a naturally falling rate, then, you know, Hayek uses the term artificial price stability.
Right.
The mainstream has no idea what that even means. But the question is not, you know, are prices rising, but are prices higher than they would have been were it not for the inflation?
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, they do. It's even worse now because the measurement of the consumer price index leaves so much out that we don't even know what real prices are. You know, leaves out housing and things like that. So it's kind of like how when the government some years ago decided it would be a good idea to put the Social Security off budget because when it was running deficits, it made the budget look bad. So don't do anything about Social Security, but take it out of the unified budget so it doesn't look as bad. Changing the CPI is sort of the same way. Well, that's a good point.
I had an economics professor that said not even Keynesian would support New Deal policies because Keynesian wanted cut taxes and increase spending simultaneously while spreading the investment. Do you agree with this assessment or no?
As Bill Clinton would say, it all depends on how you define Keynesian. Because I don't know who your professor is, but people like Paul Samuelson and James Tobin, I've read them celebrating Roosevelt for putting Keynesian-style policies into practice. So there are different Keynesians that are probably more prominent than your professor, Samuelson and Tobin, who are big fans of FDR. And wouldn't expect him to follow every exact prescription of the Keynesians. There's a book by James Buchanan and Richard Wagner called Democracy and Deficit that they published. It was published in 1976, I think. And it's sort of an evaluation of what have the Keynesians wrought. And it talks about, as all public choice analysis does, they lay out the textbook Keynesian prescriptions in a recession, cut taxes and or raise spending, and then just ask the simple question, well, what are the political incentives that politicians have? Will they cut taxes? No, they prefer to increase spending instead and run deficits instead. And that's what Keynesians will do, even though, and they're not so inclined to cut taxes, even if that's the textbook prescription. And so I'm sure people like James Tobin, who's a Nobel Prize-winning economist, along with Samuelson, understand that, even though they hated the book by Buchanan and Wagner, because they made them look kind of like fools, I think. And it's a really good book, though, but I recommend this book if you can find it. It's out of print now, as far as I know, but it's
part of the collective
work. It's part of the Liberty. That's right. He got Liberty Fund to spend all the rest of the money they had, I guess, on his collected works. Yeah, I heard. Yeah. But this is one of my favorite Buchanan books, along with Cost and Choice. That, it's probably because Wagner at the time was an Austrian, and he influenced how that book was written a lot. And Cost and Choice is an Austrian book. Any other brilliant commentaries or declarations? Yes, sir.
Why the wrong people always write history?
The wrong people, well, one reason it has to do with money. One reason it has to do a lot to do with money. Mark and I were talking about this the other day with some of the people in the room, and that the academic world is so overwhelmingly dominated by government and government money. The government universities, the research grants are overwhelmingly from the government, despite a few foundations here and there that support university research. They're just swamped by government. And so if you have a government job and you work for the government, you're not going to be necessarily too blatant about writing distorted history or pro-interventionist, pro-stated history, but you're probably not going to ask the same questions in your research that somebody like Mark or me would ask in our research. You know, just leave them lie, leave them go. And I've seen this in my career over and over and over again. And one of my very first jobs was at State University of New York at Buffalo, and I was publishing all these articles about how devious local politicians were in their setting their tax policies, and I even had, I had my dean tell me that I better watch it. It's kind of dangerous to be criticizing, and I was criticizing them in academic journals. It's not as though the political hacks in New York State were reading the National Tax Journal or something like that, which they weren't. And an extreme example I gave some of the students the other day was a man I know named Ed Krug, who was a soil chemist, who was on a big government research team to study acid rain in the 90s. And the research team, with scientists from all over the world, concluded it wasn't a big problem, acid rain. That's not what Congress wanted to hear. Ed Krug, being a naive scientist, went on 60 Minutes, a CBS television show, 60 Minutes, and explained to Ed Bradley what the scientists found. And as a result, his career was ruined. He showed me once a letter that the EPA had sent around to universities warning them not to hire him or else their grants would be pulled because they wanted this research to say the opposite to justify the Clean Air Act amendments of the early 90s, and it didn't. They were honest scientists and said, good news, we don't need another Clean Air Act amendment. That's not Congress didn't want to hear that. So his career was totally ruined by that. And a lot of that goes on in history and other fields. So that's my take on it of why so much history is written by statists. Although I read the stuff because good historians will have a lot of information in their books and articles, but we just look at it all from a different lens. If you know economics, for example, you can look at some of the same historical facts and have different ideas about what they mean. So I wouldn't say don't read what they write. Most of the history books are written by leftists. But educate yourself as well as you can and still read these books. And then you can write books criticizing them. You know, equip yourself to answer them.
Tom, I just want to point out there is a kernel of truth in the idea that FDR got us out of the Great Depression because when he died in 1945, if you look at the stock market, it actually started to go up with that.
Yeah, at least that's his final act got us out of there.
There's actually a statistical, what do you call it, break in the stock market trend at that point on the day he died.
Yeah.
And of course, when Truman replaced him, he threw out what he called the long-haired Harvard group, the last of
the Tugwell, the Tugwells of the crew, yeah. Yeah, well, Bob Higgs, and some of Bob Higgs' work, you've probably read this, he had a paper on the effect of the Roosevelt administration's haranguing of businessmen and threats to businessmen on investment. They created this whole atmosphere, even the creation of the SEC and the investigations and everything, it created a great deal of uncertainty over capital investment. Why should I invest my capital here if the administration is so threatening to me, this industry? And so he makes the case that a lot of investors held back for years during the Great Depression years. But then as soon as these people cut this out, like you said, Bob makes a pretty good case, and he gathers as much data as he can on different aspects of the stock market and so forth to make the case that it was good. The investment took off because there was much less uncertainty. So I guess I don't know who would hold responsible for that, though. That's FDR himself, I guess. Yeah. Decided to call it quits. Yeah. Well, that's what these guys from UCLA said at the end of their article. As soon as this was all over with, that's when the economy took off. That's what Higgs says. That's what everybody else says. But the biggest myth, though, is that I think that World War II ended the Great Depression because it literally did alter the unemployment statistic, but... No, people were sent to Europe and the South Pacific to fight in a war. They weren't given jobs. Yep. Anything else? Anything else? No. Well, maybe we'll call it quits for now then.
Okay, great.
Okay, thanks.